Hey, how you doing? Ha! I had to say something different because every time I start this program, I say the same thing. Welcome. Welcome, friends. I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, and welcome to ArtCast. See, that way I don't forget the essentials. I have to say, I'm Ron Jacobs, and this is ArtCast. And you know what? This is a special one-year anniversary edition because I have been podcasting for 1 year. No, not all of them have been ArtCast. Originally, I just kind of started on my personal website kind of podcasting, but it was so fun, I made it my job. Hey, how's that for fun? Well, you know what? About a year ago, I was at DS Live San Francisco, and my very first guest for my very first podcast was the man we have today, Billy Hollis, software legend, smart client guru, and just all-around great guy. He's a really fun guy to talk to. So let's give it up for Billy Hollis. Well, I am Ron Jacobs here at VS Live San Francisco, where, you know, I believe it was last year at this very event where I did my very first podcast with you, Billy Hollis.
I didn't realize that I was the very first one. But yes, I remember doing that podcast.
That's right. Yeah, and it was kind of a brand new thing. I had only heard about podcasting, I think, 2 or 3 weeks before went that event. I kind of heard about it, and I said, oh, that is too cool. I've got to do that.
Well, you have got some much more sophisticated equipment now than you did then.
That's right. I have graduated from the rookie podcast equipment now to much better stuff. So, but thanks for being here again on this anniversary.
I'm honored. I really am.
That's right. Well, you know, you're big stuff. You know, I see the .NET Insight newsletter comes to my email inbox, and there's your face, Billy Hollis, right there.
That's a new thing for me because for a long time I wanted to do some blogging, but finding the time is hard, and particularly because I didn't want to write things for 6 months before people figured out that it was there and started reading it. That just seemed like such a barrier to get past. So I was talking to Jim Fawcett about this problem, and he felt like they could use another voice on their blogging community because their folks were having a hard time getting into some rhythm of, you know, blogging is all about conversations. Uh-huh. And they thought a new voice in the mix there might help. And the kinds of promotion that you're talking about in their Insight newsletter would help get me some readership pretty quickly. And the readership has been gratifyingly large for a brand new blog. So I've enjoyed doing it. I tend a little bit too much toward rants, I think, on there. When you blog, you find things and you go, let me tell you what I don't like about this.
Yeah.
And I try to avoid that tendency, but I've had a good time doing it.
I thought it was really fun reading the one where you talked about the people all joining Microsoft.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Why they do, I think I titled that one the Twilight Zone thing. Don't come back. Yeah. Oh, come back. It's a cookbook.
Yeah, that's right.
Because that comes out of an episode where I got the email that Clemens Vasters from Germany was joining. And of course it's the phrase that people use is joining the mothership.
Yeah.
and that phrase kind of communicated my idea that there are some really good things about that. And of course, there are some downsides too, because the community outside Microsoft loses some powerful voices when people go into Microsoft.
Well, and it's funny because I think Clemens will find, as many others have, like Don Box and others, have found that once they're an employee, the reaction they get from the others is different. You know, and it's like before Don Box could say whatever, you know, and people are like, whoa, yeah, but now when he says it, they go, ah, well, he's just another Microsoft guy.
That's right. I mentioned that in the blog post is that I think that the example I used was Jim Newkirk. If Jim Newkirk, inventor of NUnit, says that a certain testing thing in VS is good, then that's one thing. But if Jim Newkirk, Microsoft employee, says it, then that's received very differently.
Yeah.
In the outside world. So that's when I talked about some of the downsides of it. But, you know, the people I've talked to who have gone there, it's been a great experience for them.
Uh-huh.
So even though the community loses some voices, Microsoft gains by it. And having that broader perspective is good for them. So as with all things, there are pluses and minuses. But just that first thought that came to my mind about the Twilight Zone episode, I just had to get that dig in.
Well, you know, it was funny because I was having a meeting the other day where we were talking about... Oh, you know, things I used to do in the community back before I joined Microsoft, which was a long time ago, 7 years ago now. And I was reflecting on, you know, what I used to do with, you know, Don Box and Chris Sells and some other guys. And I go, yeah, before we all joined Microsoft.
That's right. There are a lot of high-profile people up there. And people keep asking me, well, Billy, when are you going? And that looks like a pretty long shot. So,
well, I'm sure we could work something out.
I don't know.
Well, okay. So you were mentioning earlier about, you know, some of the things you've been thinking about now, and one of the things you said is trying to prioritize what to learn when, because there's yet another. We just got like a whole ton of stuff launched, and there's yet another tidal wave of stuff coming with WinFX and all of that. What are you focusing on?
Boy, that's a really tough problem. And when you say that we just got some stuff, that's true, but none of the stuff we got changed any fundamental models about how we did architecture or what potential kinds of applications that we could write. The 2.0 round of .NET was more about making things easier than it was about enabling brand new things. The first round of .NET enabled us to do a lot of brand new things we couldn't do before.
Well, except for you're forgetting SQL Server 2005.
Well, that's true. There are some interesting new things there, but I haven't seen dramatic changes in applications. For example, SQL Server 2005 has Service Agent, which I really like, a good, nice queuing thing, because I'd kind of outgrown MSMQ a while back because of some of the things I wanted queues to do. But I wrote a queuing engine that was SQL Server backed, and it worked. And so while it's much nicer to be able to have that functionality in the product, it didn't enable brand new kinds of applications. Now, I'm a little bit shy about some of the CLR-based stuff inside SQL Server, as I think most of us are. That may eventually lead to some interesting applications types that we couldn't do before, but the uptake on that, I think, is going to be a little bit slow because people aren't sure about the best way to use it. So I would maintain that, in general, the second round was more of a refinement, polishing round, and there are many good things in it. I really like Click Once, for example. But the next round is just a floodgate of things that enable entirely new types of applications. And then it becomes a matter of, well, where do you live? Which of these things are important to you? And what are the extraneous factors that are going to affect their adoption? So if I look at the new technologies, the one that appeals to me most naturally is WPF Avalon. Mm. Because I play on that client space. I like this idea of having this wonderful new visual stuff. I've been a proponent of vector-based systems since I used CorelDRAW 2.0 in 1990.
Ooh.
So I'm very cognizant of the advantages of a vector-based system for doing graphics. On the other hand, I'm fully aware of the fact that the typical machine in corporate America won't run Avalon right now. And I'm afraid that we're going to hit the following kind of problem. We're going to hit a situation where WPF comes out in whatever it is, a year or so, and then we've got it, but at that point the developers look at it and go, gosh, I can't run it on any of my machines internally, so I can't develop applications. Let me go to the purchasing guy and get him to change his specs. And the purchasing guy takes 6 months or a year or something to be persuaded that we need new video hardware for the new PCs coming in, because, you know, his reaction is, well, I'm not using these machines for games. We're just doing Excel here. And so the purchasing guy has to figure it out. And then you have to have enough turnover so that there's a critical mass of machines that run WPF effectively inside the organization before you're really able to take advantage of it. So from a business software perspective, I'm scared that the uptake on Avalon will be slow, both for that and the reason that people understanding how to use those capabilities to really add to the usability of the application. UI design is not one of the strengths of most business application developers. So I think we'll see a fairly slow uptake there, even though I really, really like it.
Yeah, it's like, you know, we were talking about on an earlier podcast with Walt Richardson. He was saying it's like the early days of word processors when you got a document that had 15 different fonts in it, and
right,
you know, people would be doing that kind of stuff.
I'm really scared that we're going to see some hideously ugly user interfaces, that mostly ugly in the sense of a lot of gratuitous animation and things that, that really don't matter. I mean, I look at Avalon and I see the things it's going to allow me to do that, that really excite me. For example, doing tablet PC interfaces means that you have to be pretty smart about switching between landscape and portrait, and you've got a lot of different resolutions to support. And all of those things are much better addressed with Avalon than they are with Windows Forms as they exist today. So I like that, but it's going to take me a while to figure out how to use those capabilities.
But do you think that people will be able to write an Avalon interface that's not too heavyweight? I mean, that doesn't tax the CPU too much. I mean, maybe they could start out with some easy, lighter weight Avalon interfaces that wouldn't require a whole bunch of video upgrades.
I hope that they can do that. The question is whether they can do that and get enough benefit in the usability to make it worth going beyond the Windows Forms that they already know how to do.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is some kind of a sweet spot there where there are some techniques that are fairly lightweight but still allow you to do some interesting usability things that, that you really can't do or are very impractical in Windows Forms, then I think we'll see that. But I haven't seen such examples yet.
Well, you know, the one piece of WinFX that I think, well, it's a close one, but I think the one that really excites me the most is the workflow piece.
The workflow piece is a good piece, and I've been doing some presentation on that. That was another case where I had to build my own engine, basically, so I understand and appreciate what they've done there and the fact that they've made that available. I expect to be using that. There are still some interesting things that you have to worry about before you adopt it. It doesn't come with a lot of capabilities to connectors to databases and things like that, so you have to build some things. But for fundamental state management and some of the things that go into workflow-based applications, I think it's a big step in the right direction. When I talk about workflow, I tend to break it down into work and flow. and to me, work is about work items. The tasks that have to be accomplished. And there you need some kind of a persistence mechanism or queuing or something if you're going to be distributed. And the workflow engine as it exists really doesn't address that. What it does address is the flow. Presuming that I've got these items, how do I move them from one state to another and what's got to happen to them? And I think it addresses that very effectively. So now you've got the flow part, but there's a little bit of work that you still have to do on the work part to get your items figured out.
Yeah, and I expect that's, you know, kind of stuff is pretty easy to do, right? Right, and maybe people will start producing a lot of canned engines that you can download and.
That's what I expect to see, because these are fundamentally problems that are solved almost the same way for a wide variety of scenarios. So I expect to see connectors from WWF into things like Service Agent in a pretty standard way. So you can just, you know, hydrate an item out of. Off of a queue in Service Agent, stick it into a workflow, let it wander around for a while, and there's some kind of activity in the workflow that then puts it back to the distributed queuing that means it may go into another workflow somewhere else in the system.
You know, I should point out that we can't call it WWF. Did you know that?
I thought that that was...
Yeah, I thought it was too.
I thought that they were okay with that.
It turns out that the World Wildlife Foundation has those three letters trademarked.
I knew that the World Wildlife Federation had that, but I thought Microsoft had gotten some kind of a pass on it, because at PDC I think they were pretty much okay with that terminology.
Well, I don't know. I just heard this the other day, so you know, maybe my info was out of date.
Mine could be. I thought they had managed to arrange it, because I think the discussion at the time was everybody thought it was the wrestling people that had it.
That's what I thought.
I heard from the beginning that the wildlife people.
Well, the wrestling people have been using it anyway, right?
That's right. So if they can get away with it, surely Microsoft can.
Yeah, but you know, who's going to sue them? They might come and hurt you.
And then you look at the other technologies that are interesting, especially for their long-term effects. And I think that in many respects, the two major technologies that are remaining, which are WCF, Indigo, and WinFS, the file system, I think those have some interesting complementarity in what they're going to mean long-term, because WCF enables more highly distributed systems. And I'm all into distributed systems. The smart client world springs out of that. So that excites me a lot. For instance, the idea that I can have something that looks to an application like a remote event is a big thing to me to in the kind of distributed systems that I write. But WinFS is also interesting from the point of view that if you're going to have distributed systems, now you need to study all, you need to store all kinds of structured data out there in the nodes of the system. And we really don't have a good way to do that right now. So WinFS is our mechanism for that. And now I see those two playing together to promote the idea of much more highly distributed systems with a lot more interesting peer-to-peer capabilities than some of the client-to-server capabilities that we have now.
Yeah, you know, the ability for a client application to listen on a port is huge.
Yes.
I mean, that opens up so many possibilities.
I think a lot of people aren't tuned into that, but having done a workflow-based system where, in fact, I needed that exact functionality, where a system had to know when a certain thing happened so that it knew the next step, that it was ready to take the next step in its process, I think that's hard to do now, and in a distributed sense, it's hard to do. But in a conceptual sense, it's nothing but remotes across, it's events across a network. So, yeah, I think that's going to enable a whole new class of applications.
Well, you know, and people jump through all kinds of weird hoops to make that work today. But, you know, really, if we think about just some long-running thing you want to have happen, and you fire off a message, and, you know, right now we might, you know, make an async call and kind of spin a thread and wait for a long time for a response to come back or
and
do
something. Time it out or something, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but to be able to say, you know, I'm not just going to fire this off. When that whole thing is done, somebody on the back end is going to fire me a notification, and I'm going to receive a message on this port.
That's exactly the pattern that I'd like to see, and I think that WCF is certainly going to make that pattern a lot easier than anything we have today.
Yeah, well, it's exciting to think about the possibilities there, and I'm going to have actually on our cast many, many episodes about WCF because we've already started the planning for that, so people are going to hear a lot more about the possibilities, and so they can look forward to a lot of other things there. But what else is on your mind?
Well, I'm spending some time right now on internationalization, mostly because a client that I did a large smart client for in 2002 and 2003, actually that project was a case study for a video here at VS Live in the keynote last year. Soma came down and used that as one of his case studies in his keynote. It was a big success, but when I did it, they promised me that it would only be used in the United States. Because at that time, that was their market, and that's what they saw as the only reasonable place in which to use it. But the company has grown at tremendous rates in that last 3 years, partially on the strength of having that software. I think it gives them a significant competitive edge over the others in that space. So now, at more than three times the size they were then, they're coming back saying, now people in Europe are saying, hey, you know, we'd like to take a look at this. So,
what kind of application is it? Or tell me a little bit more about it.
I think until they probably make a bunch of public announcements, I'll not go into too much in the details.
Oh, okay.
But it's right. just one of those big projects that is going to get internationalized. And I have to confess that I'm pretty far behind the curve on localization and globalization, because in healthcare, normally you don't do that.
Right.
Where I spend most of my time, you normally don't worry too much about that, because those apps are really only used in the United States. So I'm having to learn
a whole new
world. Or at
least in the local market where they were developed.
That's right. So I'm having to learn a whole new world of
internationalization. Well, and it's a lot better in .NET 2.0, though.
It is. Thank goodness we didn't have to do it in the first version, because we certainly have a lot of tools. But there are still significant pitfalls that you have to avoid. So internationalization is another area I'm having to worry about. And I think all of us are still learning new things in Framework 2, some of the things that I find new tidbits just about every day.
Well, it's funny, you know, because when I go to Europe or Canada, all those guys have been dealing with these localization issues forever, so they know all about them, and they just kind of laugh. I'm sure that some of the listeners over there are laughing out loud, thinking, what, Billy doesn't know these things? but you know, we here in America, we just write things in English, and that's, we just think that's it. That's all we have to do, you know.
That's right, especially down in Nashville, Tennessee. You know, for us, localization means being able to understand a New Jersey accent. So it's we don't really look at it the same way that people have had to do in order to deal with the American market. The markets here can be easily big enough that you don't have to worry about it. And typically, folks that do software in other countries don't have the markets that big.
Yeah, or they have government requirements like in Canada.
They can't, like, as in Canada both. With French and English,
Yeah, so, well, I'm, you know, we should probably, I'm telling you, next time I'm over there, I'm going to go ask them to educate me on this stuff, because I don't know it either. You know, I mean, I wrote, years ago, I wrote a localization tool for a different, a company that was building client server programming environment and language and whatnot. But what we used to do to test our localization out was translate all the words into reverse, you know, so you could still read them, you know, backwards and see. Anyway, that's how we did it. But many interesting things happening there. So what are you, did I ask you about what you're speaking on here at the conference already?
I don't think we've talked about that.
No, so what are you speaking on here?
Well, of course, spending most of my time in the smart client space, I tend to do a lot of speaking in that area. I did a workshop on Sunday, which was Advanced Windows Forms. That was a good 300-400 level thing on all of the stuff that I've learned in the process of doing real world projects to make Windows Forms do what I wanted it to do. I think that's that workshop and a session I'm going to do tomorrow are both to address some issues around the fact that the smart client world lags behind the ASP.NET world a bit in the starter kit kind of capability. If you want to do things in ASP.NET, you have fairly straightforward scenarios. You can go out and get something that is an end-to-end implementation that does something pretty close to what you want. It's much, much harder to get that in the smart client world. So certainly some of the things I talked about in the workshop were how to build pieces that filled in those gaps. And tomorrow morning, I'll do a session on building your own smart client construction kit. So I will talk about the general categories of pieces that you need. So that you need a shell, for example. You need the entry point for the app. And what options do you have there? Well, you have the composite application block. And then you have the possibility of building your own with certain capabilities. And then there are a couple of other example implementations floating around. And then what do you do about data validation? And what do you do about data? And Rocky has a nice framework. And so I'm going to talk about combining those pieces into something that would give you a point that a month or two into development, you ought to be well ahead of where you would be if you just kind of tried to hack it out on your own. I don't know how, you know, I'm really nervous about that session.
We'll see how it goes.
You know, sometimes you come up with a title for these sessions and you come up with a theme and they sound really good, and this one sounded good, and so they accepted it, and now I'm trying to construct it and I'm thinking, I got some problems here. One is, I don't want to come across as pushing any commercial products, but I need to mention that there are commercial possibilities. I can't go too far in depth in code because I have too many different pieces to look at. I don't want to favor my own pieces over other pieces. I'm just nervous about this one, Ryan. We'll see how this one goes. It's right after the keynote tomorrow. And then tomorrow afternoon in the Architecture Summit piece here, I'm doing a session I feel a lot better about. I think the title is, When Does a Smart Client Make Sense?
Ah.
And that is an exploration of the factors that go into the decision-making of when a smart client is a good option versus browser-based, or maybe you do a hybrid app that has both. And I've been through this process so many times that I have quite a long list of standard questions and factors to weigh in that decision. And when sometimes you sit and you do a presentation and you do the slides and they just kind of flow off your fingers. And it's just pretty clear how they need to fit together and how the discussion needs to go. So my intuition is that that first session tomorrow on the construction kit is going to be rough, and the second session tomorrow is going to go very smoothly. So we'll see how it actually turns out.
Well, you know, do you think that all of this, we've been hearing a lot about Ajax-style apps, you know, and they Atlas stuff that ASP.NET has that altered the equation of when to do a smart client any?
Oh, I think it has altered the equation somewhat, and I take that up in my session tomorrow. What we've basically got now is, 3 years ago I looked upon it as browser-based, which could kind of break down into vanilla HTML versus some kind of recent browser with, you know, some fairly significant DHTML. But I kind of lumped those together in my own mind. And then on the other side was a forms-based interface that ran in some kind of semi-detached fashion from the server. Now I think we're looking at more of a spectrum where you have intermediate points along the way, so that you have at one far end of the spectrum a very simple HTML, and then you've got something with more dynamic HTML, and then you move a little further into the intelligence direction and you've got things like Atlas and Ajax, and then you move a little bit further and you've got more forms-based interfaces, and then you move further than that and you've got occasionally connected clients with stores that are local. So I'm thinking of things now more in terms of a spectrum. And now the decision-making, it's nice to have choices, of course, but that starts to complicate the decision-making in terms of picking which point along that spectrum does this particular application need to be.
Yeah, and that's I can imagine, actually, applications where the application itself supports different points along the spectrum depending on whether it's connected or not. So maybe when it's connected, it operates in a more fully functional fashion. When it's disconnected, it's a little bit degraded, or maybe works slightly differently. And you get what I'm saying?
I think there are applications for which that would work. The real problem we have now in that entire space is that the occasionally connected scenario, just there's no good support for developing those kinds of applications. You take a lot of work on yourself when you do that. Part of the problem is we don't have WinFS. We don't have a structured file store. So now we take on the deployment of some kind of a database. And we've got all these replication issues of how do we make sure that the data that's on the client is okay with what the data that's on the server. So the whole occasionally connected thing is just messy right now. So that means that since the cost to do it is pretty high, the benefit to do it has to be high before it makes sense to take it on. And I think that barrier will get lower over time.
Okay, so when you mentioned that you did that 300-400 level talk the other day on advanced WinForms,
mm-hmm.
It reminded me of a question, a WinForms question I have, because now this is like embarrassing to say out loud, but let me just say, I don't know everything, okay? I know I work at Microsoft, but I don't know everything.
I know that I don't know everything.
But see, when you work at Microsoft, people assume everything.
All right.
There's sometimes scenarios when there's some kind of thing you want to do, but you don't want to do it until after the form is up and visible and showing, but only, like the first time when the form comes up. And I remember years ago when I used to do this with C programming, and I used to just, when the form was being initialized, I would post a message back to the form. And then, by the time that got around to processing that message, everything would be initialized and showing. And then when I got that message, then I would do the whatever thing I wanted to do. But I can't seem to figure out how to do that with WinForms.
Well, I'm not sure if I understand the nature of your question, but at one level, if what you want to accomplish can't be done in the load event, then you almost have to do a little bit of kludge. But you can do a lot in the load event, because the load event doesn't fire until after the constructor has done a lot of things and initialized all the controls. So when you get to the load event, you have pretty much carte blanche access to all the things that are on the form at that point. Now, there are a few scenarios in which there are some things that you'd like to do in form load and you can't. And I'll have to show you the kludge, basically.
Okay.
There are a couple of kludges that will allow you to do some things in some other events. Those events will fire a lot, but what you basically do is you set a switch so that you only
do it
the first time.
Yeah, that's what I thought, it was something like that, because, I was thinking, now the whole idea of the message pump and all that is so hidden from you.
That's right.
That you don't, I don't even know if you can post a message back to you. You can't send a user-defined message or...
You can do it, but it's messy. You have to be doing some, you have to override some Windows processing stuff. And it's something that I haven't found a good reason to do it yet. I've managed to avoid doing that every time I thought I was going to have to.
Yeah. Okay, so here's another one. So I was writing this app to actually help for speaking, and it has a little timer, and I set how long I'm going to be speaking, and then it counts down. And what I wanted to do was make this font in the label very scalable. So if the window was maximized, the numbers were really big, and if the window was shrunk down, they would shrink accordingly. you know, and I had the hardest time. I made that labeled like Doc, but I've had a very hard time figuring out how to scale that font up and down. And somebody mentioned to me there was some kind of automatic way to do this, but couldn't figure out what it was.
Well, I think in Windows Forms 2, there's some automatic stuff that based on the size you. But you know, I've done it with. I've used the automatic stuff in the sense that when I change the font, the other stuff changes in uh-huh. size. I don't think I've tried to do it the other way, where I change the size and then scale the font to fit. So I'd have to look and see. Now, there's another way that I can think of that would certainly work, even back in 10111, and that would be to do a little bit of a measure string to measure the height and kind of figure out what height is appropriate.
That's what I ended up doing.
Yeah. And that's a bit of a kludge, but that's the first thing I would think of if I didn't have an automatic capability.
Well, you know, there is an auto scale thing.
Yeah.
But that has more to do with the DPI scaling.
That's right.
And so anyway, maybe that's what this person was telling me about, and they didn't understand what my problem
right.
was.
Now, that is something that people moving from 1.1 to 2.0 need to understand, is that's one of the changes, is that we had this, let's see if I can remember the properties, the auto base scale mode, something that was used in 1.1 is now an obsolete property.
Yeah.
And it was basically a true false kind of way of scaling. And now there are several different scaling options. And so that thing is obsolete, and what you normally do is wipe it out and then pick one of the four scaling options that's available in Windows Forms 2.
Okay, so there you go. I've got my advanced Windows Forms questions answered. Well, at least I was sitting there thinking I must be dumb, because somebody told me, oh, there's some automatic thing that doesn't make this happen, and I couldn't figure out what it was. But anyway, I think you're right, because I looked and looked and looked, and I ended up just, you know, doing the math and doing measure string and trying to calculate how big of a font I could make, and it works reasonably well. So, I mean, it's just a little app that I use for myself, so it doesn't have to be perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, thanks, Billy, for being here with me on ArtCast.
Oh, you're welcome, Ron. I appreciate you having me.
Billy Hollis, ladies and gentlemen, software legend. I was so honored just to be in the same place with such greatness. Oh, Billy wouldn't say that. No, he would kind of blush, I think, you know, but he's a smart guy. And very, very nice guy. A guy that will just help you and give you all kinds of great advice. And I have so much more, because the whole time I was in San Francisco there at VS Live, I was sitting in this big room, you can kind of hear it echoing around in there, and just talking to speaker after speaker, and we had a lot of fun there. You know, this is a kind of an interesting way for you to experience the event without being there. Of course, it's better if you're there, but hey, if you can't be there, you can listen to ArtCast.